Thank you, Mr. Haney, and good Pentecost afternoon to all of you. I want to get my thank yous out of the way here. That'll take about 40 minutes. We'll have a short sermon. I do want to thank the choir. They did just a wonderful job. It was a very inspiring piece, applicable to all of us, timely and truly well done. We really appreciate it very, very much to all of you involved in that. My wife and I want to thank all of you for allowing us to come here this weekend. No one was at the hotel when we got there saying, "Horchak's, go home," and so we felt like we were we were welcomed. Seriously, when we got to the hotel on Friday night, we were greeted by a big, beautiful gift basket that I'm sure all of you knew what was going to be given to us. But, you know, the gal behind the desk at the hotel said, "Well, you must be somebody very special." Because, I mean, this gift basket that you all gave us, which had all kinds of goodies, water, you name it, it had it. And it was just wonderful. And I thought about it, you know, when that gal said that, I thought, well, yeah, I am, in spite of myself. And I meant that. I didn't say that to her. But I got to thinking about the meaning of the weekend, quite honestly, you know. And she said, "You must be somebody pretty special." It kind of, when Mr. Ellis was speaking, it kind of reminded me of the gal behind the desk at the hotel. But I want to thank all of you for that as well. I want to thank all of the elders. And I thank Mr. Ellis again for, I know, the work that he's put into securing this facility and being sure that we behave ourselves while we're here. And rightly so. Having pastored for a lot of years, and many of you have served in the church, you know that when you get a new facility, you want to take care of it. An old facility you want to take care of as well, but something as nice as this place is, you really want to take care of it and make sure that we comply with their requests, and really nice that we could meet here. Want to greet those on the webcast. I think I see the camera, unless that's a fake camera back there, but I'm sure it's not. But I want to greet all of those who are tuning in on the webcast for the Holy Day. I know one of the couples that are online, at least they said they were going to attempt to be, is Mr. and Mrs. Harold Rhodes. And many of you know Mr. Rhodes and his wife. Mr. Rhodes retired from the full-time ministry here recently in November. But as I think many of you know, he was actually honored this year at the conference for 50 years of serving in the ministry of Jesus Christ, although Harold and Laurie have not been able to attend the conference for the last 4 or 5 years, actually, because of his health, which I think many of you are aware of. And I really hope that Harold and Laurie were able to join us for the Holy Day as well. This has been a very busy time in the church, not just because it's Pentecost weekend. I'm sure all of you could tell your stories in your life about how busy you are. Everyone has their story about how busy they are, and that's a good thing. But in the church as a whole, it has been, and we try to do as good a job as we can communicating with the church through In Accord on Fridays, at least most weekends. We don't have them every weekend. And in other ways, so I won't repeat things that you probably know, but it is a very busy time. Most of the ministers in the office were out in different church areas, or in a few cases, like with Dr. Levy and Mr. Dave Johnson, they're in Israel, with those who are touring in Israel. So quite a few are out this weekend of the office. You know, one of the things I want to mention before getting into the sermon, which is not lost on, I think, all of you here, simply because of the involvement that there have been with three different couples that have been involved in the Focus Mentoring Program, is just the great priority we have in the church and continue to have in both finding and training leaders and pastors for the church for the future, for the present and future, I may add. It's not just the future. The future is now. And we've heard phrases like that for different reasons, but it's true in the church. It really is. The need is great to have individuals that can serve and God's people in many ways, not the least of which is caring for and shepherding God's people, which is a huge responsibility. It's a great responsibility, and it's one that I'm encouraged that I think a lot of our younger, I'm not calling them young, they've got their own families, so just younger than I am anyway, have continued to step up and serve in the church, and we're so grateful for that. It is essential for the lifeblood of the current church and its future. All of you probably are well aware of the International Leadership Program that was initiated last year. And Mr. Franks has spent quite a bit of time online talking about it, but I just want to comment on that as well. We have four more trips that we're making internationally to actually have extended weekend educational seminars for couples that the pastors in those areas have recommended to come to those weekends. We'll be going later this month to Rwanda in Central Africa. Many of the French-speaking areas in Africa will be represented there, as well as a few couples coming from Kenya in East Africa. And then in late July, we'll be going to South Africa in Johannesburg, where we will actually have some couples from South Africa, as well as from Zimbabwe, Malawi, and Zambia that will be coming to these leadership training classes. And then in early August in the Caribbean, where all of us will be taking 3 weeks vacation in an all-inclusive. No, we won't be doing that. It's tempting, but no. There'll be a number of couples from the Caribbean, from the different islands that are represented for a weekend there. And then at the end of August, we'll be finishing up this round of the International Leadership Program in the United Kingdom. We'll have some couples not only from the UK, but also a few from the mainland in Europe. So it's a busy time, but I only bring that up to emphasize the importance that we continue to place on development of all of us. It's not just about developing a few people for certain responsibilities, but we do know that the church needs oversight and care and nurturing and shepherding. And I know I'm speaking to a few of those who will be fulfilling that responsibility in the future in this room. I can say that in many congregations. And it's an important part of being in the church these days, and it's all leading to something even bigger than that. And so I do want to thank all of you in the church for your continued prayers and support of the church. And I don't mean that just financially. That's important. But the more important support that you and I actually give to the church is what we give to God's church on our knees in praying and asking for God's mercy, for his continued guidance, for his continued patience with all of us. I surely ask for that a lot, not just with my wife and friends, but with God as well. And I know that when we do that as God's people, he'll give us guidance. He'll give us direction. He'll see us through, as the hymn says, and that's a wonderful thing. As was mentioned earlier today by one of the many Pavliks who are here, the many people have endured quite a bit of upheaval in the church over the last many decades, and they're still here, and many of you are here, and we're all thankful for that. And we do have a few people that are probably new converts. That's a wonderful thing as well, but I think it is a testimony to the spiritual strength of many of God's people and their commitment to what they came to know and understand decades ago. And for many of you who have grown up in the church and have really, when I say seamlessly, I don't know that anybody's life is seamless. Mine surely isn't. It's got its wrinkles, seams, and it's had its need for being sewn up here and there, metaphorically speaking. But for those who have grown up in the church and remained fundamentally a part of the church, you still have recognized that sometimes the going gets a little bit tough. You got to put your seatbelt on and continue to look forward, and God sees us through. And it is a wonderful thing to be able to recognize that on such a special day as the day of Pentecost, because indeed it was a very special day indeed. June 17th, 31 AD, June 6th, 1944 AD. What do these dates have in common? What do these two dates of June 17th, 31 AD, and June 6th, 1944 AD have in common? June 17th, 31 AD is our best calculation of the date of the first Pentecost of the Church of God in the first century, 1,988 years ago. God's Holy Spirit was given to his people on that day, as we've already heard today, and God's church, in a spiritual sense, began in earnest on June 17th, 31 AD. On June 6, 1944, that was the date of the largest military flotilla, the largest landing of troops of war in the history of the world, that took place on the beaches of Normandy in 1944. It was D-Day, a day when the Americans and Allied troops suffered 10,000 casualties in one day while striving to reclaim Europe from Nazi Germany and the Third Reich. Over 156,000 troops landed on June the 4th of 1944. And of course, ultimately, as World War II ended over the next 2 years, it would take 407,000 lives. Today, I want to talk about what these 2 days have in common and how we as the Church of God should strive to deeply and truly understand who we are. Who we are. 3 days ago, most of the free world recognized the 75th anniversary of D-Day, of June 6, 1944, of the Normandy invasion of Allied troops on the shores of France. Germany had been at war for almost 6 years to claim and to build its empire in Europe and Northern Africa. And on that date, Britain had been ravaged by bombing from the Germans for almost 2 years. France, Italy, Poland, Netherlands, and other parts of the Middle East had fallen to the German army. General George Marshall, a name many of you will recognize, was correct a couple of years before in 1942 when he said that only an invasion of France and a campaign to Berlin would ensure the defeat of Nazi Germany. But it took fully 2.5 years before the Allies had the necessary amounts of troops, training, and war materiel to attempt an invasion of Northern Europe. Adolf Hitler knew that the Americans and the Allied forces were coming. History proves that out. The Germans did not know exactly where or when they would be attacked, but their Atlantic wall that they built on the Western Front of defenses were built to blunt our forces. The military plans of what was called Operation Overlord were astonishingly complex. It was a massive, vast operation full of movement, timetables, and logistical schedules across the air, the sea, and the land. Problems in any of these moving parts could jam up and spread through the entire operation and lead to total failure. Unforeseen events and uncontrollable factors, including but not limited to weather, soil conditions, spies, deception plans, and pure luck could change events and outcomes. History over the years was replete with failed crossings of the English Channel. The Spanish failed to invade England in 1588. Napoleon failed in 1805. And in 1940, Hitler failed to cross after Dunkirk. All of these operations were from the continent to England. But the Allied operation to cross was in the opposite direction, from England to the continent, with the largest and most complex military force ever assembled and defying all odds. Finally, where the Americans were at this point in the war, the Allies, primarily US and Britain, had only one chance for Operation Overlord to succeed. And they knew it. All the rocks were in one bag, and they had one opportunity. There was no plan B to defeat Nazi Germany. Thousands of 18 and 19 year olds, and they primarily were barely out of high school, put their life on the line to liberate France and ultimately Europe. And of course, most of the American forces landed on Omaha Beach that day, where the great number of casualties took place. You know, for us in 2019 to understand what was at stake, and for many people who may not be students of history, or maybe so young that they really don't have a focus on this, to really understand what was at stake 75 years ago, what if the U.S. and Allied forces at Normandy had failed? What if they had failed? What if the Germans drove the Allies back into the English Channel that day and the next day? What would have been the results? The immediate situation would have been this. Had they failed, it would have taken another 2 years before Allies could remotely hope to have the resources to attempt another invasion. 2 to 2.5 years. Political support in the United States and Britain would totally erode. The Soviet Union would likely have made a separate peace with Nazi Germany and forcing the United States and Britain to then make separate deals. Hitler's regime would have survived. Two catastrophic results would have taken place, and they can be reliably predicted if Hitler survived to power. Democracy in Western Europe would have been eliminated, and the Holocaust would have continued, and the world and its future totally changed. But that did not happen. Instead, beginning with the bloodshed on the beaches of Normandy on June 6, 1944, and through the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Allied troops over the next 11 months on the road to Berlin, by May of 1945, Nazi Germany was destroyed. Western civilization survived. That was 75 years ago. And the anniversary of D-Day, June 6, just 3 days ago, is now remembered by millions of people in US and Europe and around the world, because many people do understand what was at stake. And they do understand the turning point in World War II and the turning point in world history that took place 75 years ago, last Thursday. Now, the Feast of Pentecost is also a very special day. The day set aside by Almighty God, not by merely man and the doings of man. And we know that Pentecost is a day going back to the Old Testament with ancient Israel, God's law was given. A very important part of our understanding of the meaning of the day of Pentecost. It is also a day upon which the incredible power of the Spirit of God was granted to his people for the first time. And a power described in such a way as it was this morning by Mr. Henderson, and more importantly, the scripture, that really was a one-time special event. Even though God has granted his Holy Spirit to thousands of others over the last 1900 plus years that have repented, individuals that he's called and have turned their lives over to him. But both the law of God and the Spirit of God are used by the people of God today in part of what defines our work, the job that God has given us to do. You know, the day of Pentecost in some ways, brethren, is similar from a spiritual perspective. It's similar from a spiritual perspective in terms of the memorial of D-Day of June of 1944, in that our work and calling was the beginning of an offensive work of God, spiritually speaking. A work aimed at liberating all of mankind. Not just France, not just the democracies of Western Europe, but liberating all of mankind. You know, what's at stake in terms of what God has called you and me to do is not less than, it's greater than what was at stake 75 years ago. Think about it. It's the same planet with the same problems and the same human beings that are born day in and day out and begin to draw the breath of life. The anniversary of D-Day at Normandy evokes great appreciation for soldiers that sacrifice for their country, not just on that day. But it really symbolized people that have given their life and sacrificed for what they believed to be a do-or-die situation. The day of Pentecost, of course, rather than just a memorial, marks the day when God would begin working with those that he called from different backgrounds into his family to do his work, to be a part of his offensive push, to liberate mankind. And as the first fruits of God, who indeed are the chosen and the few, we as soldiers of Jesus Christ are bonded together in a common and most just of all causes. 5 years ago, in the summer of 2014, I had the unique chance, as my wife and I did, to visit with and spend, 45 minutes or so with George W. Bush, who had been president of the United States. The reason for that was connected to our son being deployed for the first time to Afghanistan. It was a fascinating visit, to say the least. And of course, Mr. Bush talked shop with our son, Greg, being two pilots. He answered questions that I respectfully asked of him regarding the subject of 9/11. And of course, he was convinced that it was a just war against terrorism and tyranny. And he asked me the question, do you believe in evil? Now, I realize that Mr. Bush's dialogue, to some degree, was a justification of some of the decisions and actions he took, and I'm not here to talk about the politics of that. But what struck me that day was that is what he felt. He had the utmost respect for those that sacrificed their life and were put in harm's way to defend this country and its way of life. But, you know, all of what I heard from him that day was based on his limited knowledge and his limited understanding of the world that we live in. You know, who was I? You know, who were my wife and I in that sense? Here we were talking to what conceivably could be said was the most powerful man in the world for 8 years. And he was speaking with a limited understanding of the world we live in that you and I understand in some respects better than he did. So based on that limited understanding, the conclusion that he came to about what needed to be done was reasonable, I feel. It was reasonable in the ignorance of knowing God's true way. A way, of course, that is the only way that's going to liberate not just Europe, but all of mankind. You know, I've found over the years that sometimes we in the church can shrink just a little bit, you know, from who we are when we stand up against a world that is describing itself the way that our world does today, and gives great honor and respect to those who have given the ultimate sacrifice in some respects to defend liberty and to defend the rights and the freedoms that we have. And sometimes feel like we wish we could do more. We don't like to be perceived as pacifists when it comes to wanting to overcome evil in this world. None of us want to be viewed that way. That's understandable. But brethren, on the day of Pentecost, I think it's one of the days that we need to really stop and ponder and think about all aspects of why we've been called, and realize that there's no need for any of us in the church to ever shrink from the impact and the difference that God's people are destined to make on this world. No need to shrink from that at all. That doesn't mean we do not have a level of respect and deep appreciation for the sacrifice that other human beings that don't know what we do have given. We can and we should. But when you think about it, and it occurred to me, you know, previous to Memorial Day and leading up to the memorial of D-Day here just a couple of days ago, that the reason that the United States and the reason these young men, 17, 18, 19 years old, scared straight in those landing craft and sitting ducks for the Nazis as they landed and were picked off like ducks. They thought that it was the only choice they had in terms of Western civilization to do what they did. And in some respects, they were right. But they were fighting for just a portion on a very physical plane of what we've been called to be a part of and to do and to accomplish. When we understand the truth of our role as first fruits, we shouldn't have to ever apologize or hang our heads for what God's called us to do. Now, I may add, it's not an easy job, as we've already heard today. It's not a simple job. It's not one for the faint-hearted. That's one of the reasons why many of us in this room, including myself, had to think long and hard before I got baptized. And then I found out later that what was expected of me was even bigger than I thought it would be at the ripe old age of 19 when I was baptized. And like you, my understanding of what God's called us to, not only in what was required of us, but also the magnanimity of our future has grown incredibly since I've come into the church. You know, after Jesus Christ was crucified and resurrected, he took on a very important role. Actually, it was multiple roles. But a unique role is described in Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 10 of being the captain of our salvation. It's an interesting use of the Greek term captain. It really means the same term that they would use a captain of armies. And of course, what did Christ sacrifice? Well, for all of those men and women in uniform that sometimes are recognized in real time, at other times on Memorial Day, for having given the ultimate sacrifice, and many of them have. Jesus Christ did as well, but in a way and in a manner that no other human being ever has. But as he is called the captain of our salvation, we are metaphorically a lot of different things. But one of the things we're referred to by the Apostle Paul is soldiers. And I believe that for the purpose of the message today, we are soldiers in a battle that few people even know is taking place. A view that this world sees very differently than we do. For what country or government do we actually fight? I'd like you to turn to John chapter 18. John 18. This, of course, is the account, John's account of the day that Christ was actually crucified, when he was before Pilate. But the subject that we're talking about today actually came up, as we'll see. John 18, verse 33. John 18 and verse 33. Then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" And Jesus answered and said to him, "Say you this thing of yourself, or did others tell you this of me?" So he's asking this of Pilate. And Pilate answered, he said, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you unto me. What have you done?" And Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews, but now is my kingdom not from hence." He didn't just hint at, he made it very clear that his kingdom, the one that he represented, and quite honestly, the one that his disciples represented, was not of this world. Christ made the case that it wasn't of this world, and we know it was of another world, the one to come. Paul referred to this world as the present evil world, rather than the one to come. We know we live in a world that's evil. I don't think you would have had to convince any of the young men that was on those landing craft, you know, in the dark of night of June the 6th, 1944, that we lived in an evil world. And many of the military minds that devised this plan of Operation Overlord, you didn't have to convince them that they lived in an evil world. You didn't have to convince Winston Churchill, who begged, actually, to be on one of those flotilla in the English Channel when his troops were going ashore. And it was only after an interaction the day before with the king and arguing with Eisenhower that he wasn't allowed to do it. He changed his mind. They knew that the world that they lived in was wrought in evil. And if that evil, as they saw it and they understood it, wasn't stopped, Western civilization would come to an end. Jesus Christ made the statement that his kingdom is not of this world. He didn't say his servants don't fight. He didn't say that there's not a battle to be waged on a spiritual level. But he did say that they weren't going to stop Christ from being crucified because it was part of the plan. He explained to Pilate that his servants would not fight in defense. At the same time, Jesus Christ is teaching his disciples about the spirit and intent of God's law, that law governs his kingdom. And that kingdom, in an embryonic sense, exists within the church, within the hearts and minds, but more importantly, within the functioning of the group of God's people. And of course, it's an approach that is far removed from human anger, hatred, and resisting of evil. Because why? Well, we are being trained to think differently. Military troops are taught to kill. They're taught other things. It's not easy for human beings to take the life of another human being. God is training his troops differently. Because man's way, which of course results in war, is the very system that Jesus Christ and his kingdom is coming to supplant, to change. Notice in Matthew chapter 5, Matthew 5, this is one of the many places where Christ attempted to teach his disciples about a new way of thinking. It was very counterintuitive to them. And I'll have to say that even as a young convert, and in the years since my baptism, there have been times when I read through the the teachings of Jesus Christ in the Sermon on the Mount, or read of how Jesus Christ thought. We know Paul made reference to that in Philippians chapter 2. That even I have sometimes a difficult time wrapping my brain and conscience around the way that Christ thinks. Now, I hope I've made progress in my life some, because it's not the way the normal human being thinks. Notice Matthew 5, verse 38. You have heard that it has been said, so Christ is teaching his disciples, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you that you resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite you on the right cheek, you turn the other also to him. And if any man will sue you at the law and take away your coat, let him have the cloak, your cloak also. And whosoever shall compel you to go a mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to him that ask of you, and from him that would borrow of you, turn not away. You have heard that it has been said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Now, God's word never told them to hate their enemy. But they were taught that. They believed that. And quite honestly, the natural human reaction to one's enemy is to ultimately not like them and eventually hate them. But what did Christ say? Verse 44, but I say to you, love your enemies. Huh? Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them that despitefully use you and persecute you. That doesn't make sense to most people. And I submit to you that this doesn't make sense to a lot of us all the time. I'm including myself into all of us. We're human, we're flesh. We can get pushed. Our emotions can sometimes overrule what we know in our head about what's right and what's best and how Jesus Christ thought. But God's working with us, patiently, lovingly. Clearly, there was a new way of thinking, of living, and of acting as a representative of another government or a country that Jesus Christ made reference to when he taught his disciples, as it's recorded here in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. This was very, very different than the human way of thinking, and only made possible by what? It's only made possible by the Spirit of God. But we can make a difference. We can make a difference for the government and the kingdom that we represent as God's people. If so, how do we fight? And why should we fight? What are we fighting? If I'm using this analogy or this metaphor of a war and a battle and soldiers, what are we fighting? Ephesians 6. Most of the rhetorical questions I'm kind of throwing at all of you, you know the answers to. You know where I'm going. That's a good thing. Ephesians 6 and verse 10. At the end of this letter that Paul wrote to the church at Ephesus, he says, finally, my brethren, and he was encouraging them because he knew that the Christian life sometimes is a battle. And as we heard in the special music just moments ago, he starts here in verse 10. He says, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord. He didn't say be strong, you know, go and work out, you know, get your percentage of fat down. Those are good things, I get, you know, for one's health. I'm not suggesting that. He's not talking about just getting strong personally so you can fight a good battle on a physical basis. It's not what he's talking about. He said, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. That there's a sermon just in that phrase there. How do we do that? How do we become strong in the power of the might of God as opposed to our own? Well, it's called Christian growth. It's called building a relationship with God in Jesus Christ and learning through or submitting to him to think like Christ thought. That didn't come naturally. I can assure you the day I got baptized when I was a freshman at Ambassador College, I didn't come out of there thinking differently, you know. I was kind of intimidated by what just took place. I was cautious for a while. I mean, you know, you're cautious, but because, well, I'm newly baptized. But I found out in the, really, probably hours, but if not the days and weeks that followed, I was still the same carnal Doug Horchak, but I had some help. Other people who knew me would say, you needed help, Doug, but that's not unlike all of us. I'm not saying it didn't change, but it just didn't change overnight. To think differently. He says, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. And the wiles, you could, again, there's a sermonette in that one. Probably some of you have done such. What does that word mean? And it has to do with trickery. It has to do with deception on several levels, which, by the way, is a part of war. They say that one of the most detailed efforts to deceive another major military power took place in the months leading up to D-Day. We actually, I'm talking about the Allied forces, actually had two fake sets of troops, both in Scotland and in Britain. They didn't exist. There was a lot of ruses and lights and communications that took place. And that was what the Allied troops, what the Americans were doing to try to misdirect the focus of Nazi Germany. And it worked. That's part of warfare. That's not new to World War II. Here that's what we're talking about when it says, be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. But verse 12 is what I want to focus on. One verse here. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood. Paul well knew that soldiers do wrestle against flesh and blood. They fight them. And at this point in time in human history, is often one-on-one. They didn't have drones and smart bombs. It was usually one-on-one. He was reminding the church that this isn't our battle. There are those who do that battle. There are those, because of their lack of understanding and their ignorance of the truth, that's the way that they believe they're going to solve human problems. He wasn't criticizing that, even though it's not God's way and it's not going to solve it. He said, what you need to see is that we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but we do wrestle. We do fight. We do have a battle. Rest assured. We battle and wrestle against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. He's speaking to the church, not just the leadership of the church. It's all of us. Why? Because the rulers of darkness of this world, and you know who we're talking about here, wants to destroy you and wants to destroy the army that you represent. He wants to destroy the government that you represent and I represent. And he doesn't go on vacation or take 2 weeks off in the summer after school, talking about Satan. He doesn't take time off. And of course, we shouldn't take time off being a Christian. You don't do that. You may get time off from work and take a vacation, and which is a great thing when you do that. But when it comes to this battle, it's not the way it works. This is an extremely important truth for us to understand, that we are using this metaphor, a small group of soldiers fighting a battle that the world does not even understand, preparing for a government the world does not see. The battle we fight, in some respects, as you consider this world, is an invisible war in the eyes of the world around us. The enemy we struggle against does not primarily use nuclear or chemical weapons. The work we do, the struggle we have, can sometimes, brethren, if we don't focus on it the right way, become a very lonely battle. It need not be that way. As first fruits on the day of Pentecost, we're reminded that we were called, or as the Greek term klesis actually can be rendered, drafted by God. I remember when I was in high school, the draft was invoked in the 1960s. And you had to register, but you also would be drafted if you fit the bill, or if you didn't get a student deferment or whatever. And that was in the middle of transitioning in the late 1960s when I was in high school. Presently, the draft laws we have in the United States are pretty interesting.
virtually all male U.S. male citizens, regardless of where they live, and male immigrants, whether documented or undocumented, residing in the U.S. who are 18 through 25 are required to register for the Selective Service. That's true today. Has been for a couple of decades. And of course, the difference is that you register. That doesn't mean there's a draft going on. Again, when I was in high school, the word draft meant something because you knew that you were going to be in boots on your way to Vietnam unless there was some alternative, or you were going to school or whatever the case might be. And it was a reality. The draft is not invoked today, but people have to register for it. I did a little bit of research. In World War II, approximately 35% of the U.S. forces that were involved in World War II volunteered. The other two-thirds were drafted. Again, those are basic numbers. But it's interesting that amidst the hellish wall of destruction and death that many of these young men had to go into, that still a full third of them volunteered to go. Of course, that's not to mention many of the ladies that were back stateside that were doing their work to support the war effort. My mother worked in a factory that made grenades in Pennsylvania in the early 1940s. There were a lot of females that were back stateside that were doing what they felt was their part in all of that. Now, how does that relate, though, to us? You know, the difference is, compared to what I had to deal with when I was in high school, is that when you and I are drafted by God, I'll use that term because you can use them with a little bit of poetic license interchangeably with being called. The difference is that you can choose, because in the 1960s, you couldn't say, okay, Uncle Sam, you've drafted me, but my answer is no, thank you. You couldn't get away with that back then. It's true today in the U.S., the Army's all volunteer. When it comes to the Church of God, you get drafted. You may wonder why you, as Mr. Ellis was referencing earlier out of 1 Corinthians, I mean, it's true. We don't always know why God chose to call us, and particularly as it relates to how we stack up against, from a worldly perspective, the rest of the world financially and him being of great import and famous. God calls us, but the difference is that you and I choose to respond to that call. Just like if you get an invitation over someone's house 2 weeks from next Saturday night for dinner, you can either say, thank you, but we've got other plans or can't make it, or you can say, yes, we'll go. That's the difference. And from God's perspective, all of us volunteered. After being given the opportunity, we were volunteers. We said, me, choose me. And he didn't choose us last for the pickup game. He chose us first, but only after we were invited by him. So I won't spend much time on 1 Corinthians 1:26, as Mr. Ellis covered it quite well. But we should see that calling and understand that calling, and particularly as it relates to the point I'm trying to make today. God does want his people to understand the nature of what he's called us to do. Now, it goes beyond using a military metaphor for us being a part of the army of God in terms of a work that he has for us to do. There's many other aspects to that in one sense. But for the sake of connecting it to D-Day and what was at stake 75 years ago, I think it fits perfectly. You know, the work that you and I do, and I'm talking about the work that goes on in your personal life, whether it be struggles, whether it be knowledge and understanding, mistakes that you make, things that you're doing to improve yourself and to serve and help the needs of others, the work that you do, the changes that you and I voluntarily choose to go through because we know that we need to, the battle that we face to realize is just as many of the military history of our country felt. You know, an 18-year-old in the Army in 1944, many of them felt they had no choice but to go to battle, not just because they were forced to by Uncle Sam, but they were convinced that if they didn't, and the military minds knew that the casualties at Normandy would be high. They knew that. And many of those young men knew that a significant percentage of them might die. They knew that. But many of them were convinced and fraught with fear as well that the future of Western civilization hung on whether or not they were a part of that effort. They had no choice because they also knew what might happen if they failed. That led to the use of the terminology a just war. A just war. Now, we're very good in the United States, I found out, at saying that every war we're involved in initially is a just war. And I'm not here today to present my political position on that. This isn't a political message. This has to do with life and death, of which many thousands of people have innocently strived to put their life on the line to protect what they felt was a need to protect, whether it be their own life, their family's life, the life of their country. We, as the first fruits of God, are fighting a war that few will ever fight that live in this world. In 2 Timothy 2, verse 1. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 1. Paul writing to Timothy. So here you have a more seasoned pastor, albeit he had an incredible, unique calling, as was mentioned today as well. He did. But here he's writing to Timothy. And at times he had to encourage Timothy. Timothy was a pastor. He was working with brethren. He was also dealing with some of the forces of heresy that tried to encroach the church. And sometimes with government officials. That's what many had to do in Asia Minor in pastoring congregations. And so in light of that, we find in verse 1 of 2 Timothy chapter 2, Paul said, "You therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. And the things that you have heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit you to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also." So they were involved in training and developing those that God may be calling into responsibilities of service and leadership back then. And that's what Paul was trying to encourage Timothy to do. But notice what he said in verse 3. "You therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ." It's not always going to be easy. Sometimes it's tough. "No man that wars entangles himself with the affairs of this life." In other words, if you're going to represent me, you can't let yourself get so wrapped up in this world and try to represent me as well in a war that these people in the world don't even know exists. "That he may please him who has chosen him to be a soldier." It's an interesting statement that Paul makes, that we have been chosen to be a soldier. In a spiritual sense, fighting a battle that few people know and even appreciate right now. "And if a man also strive for masteries, yet he is not crowned except he strive lawfully." The day of Pentecost has much significant symbolism, not the least of which is the responsibility that we have as the first fruits of God in this life to prepare for God's great harvest in the future. You know, unlike 1944, and I repeat, unlike 1944, our work that we're involved in is not just about survival. It's not just about survival, but survival and growth and development of all mankind to a potential that none of them have ever dreamed of. Jesus Christ and the Apostle Paul likened our job to a soldier of Jesus Christ. And as such, it takes the vision, it takes the commitment and the conviction of a mission. And some of you who are veterans know the term mission. Our unique calling, our conscription to a responsibility that requires strength, it requires vision, it requires an understanding of the purpose behind the mission that Jesus Christ gave to us. It requires a measure of sacrifice and a willingness to give our life for our country. In this case, we're talking about the one that Christ referred to in John 18. And one that you and I sat on the other side of a table or a coffee table when a minister was counseling us for baptism, and he was reading from Luke 14. when he talked about counting the cost. And I, with all the deep knowledge I had of what the future held at age 19, said, yes, choose me. And I'm willing to give my life up for what I believe in. And I'm not going to follow my family if they take off and go a different direction from the church. Well, guess what? At that time, I was broke. I didn't have much to give up. I was clueless when it came. Maybe not clueless, but close to it when it came to what it means to really give your life for something. And all of my family was in the church. I found out since then, as all of you have, that you know, God, Christ meant what he said. It's recorded in Luke 14. And we need to be willing to do that. Now, fortunately, God, in his love, in his patience, in his mercy, and knowing that we're flesh and blood, he helps us with these commitments. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, Paul made this statement here to the church at Corinth, and he was trying to help the brethren there. Now, this is 2 Corinthians as opposed to 1 Corinthians, and it's significant knowing that this is a follow-up letter to a very corrective one he sent some months before. But notice what he said here in verse 16. For which cause, in other words, and he's talking about one's calling, for which cause we faint not, but though our outward man perish, in other words, physically things may be slowing down and not look good, though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, works for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. You know, like many of you, I've read these words of Paul dozens of times. And some years ago, it occurred to me, this almost sounds like a coach in a locker room at halftime with a team that's down by 10 points. Letting them know there's, you know, you've got to believe in yourself. You've got to believe in what you can do. Now, of course, we're not talking about basketball or football today. We're talking about, you know, the ultimate game, and it's really not a game. 75 years ago, Operation Overlord and the work that and goal that they wanted to accomplish, the outcome of that day, was described as 24 hours that changed the world. If you type, if you Google that, it'll come up D-Day. Or it will have changed the tide and saved all of Western civilization. Millions of people remembered those young men whose lives paid the price for a temporal reprieve from the despotism of war, of death, and of fascism that Nazi Germany was imposing upon Western Europe and ultimately all of the world. And yet 75 years later, the world still stands on the precipice of division, confusion, violence, and war. And the work that we're called to as the first enlistees in the family of God will be seen in the future. It's not understood now, but it will be seen in the future as the true and only just war, a work that will have truly changed the world. Today in 2019, as members of God's church, we are involved in a battle that few people see and few people recognize. The determination and passion of our commission that each of you show in your lives is not covered on Fox News or CNN at night. The sacrifice of God's people for the true cause of peace is not known by most people in the public. The fortitude and duty of you, who I would call invisible soldiers of the work of God, is not referred to by our president when he speaks to the nation. But we must be filled with the strength and confidence that speaks to the kingdom, the government, and the way of life that we are privileged to represent. You know, for years when going to war, many have wanted to know the goal, the mission, the outcome of sending our men and women in uniform into battle. And of course, that hue and cry has increased over the last 10 years because of much of the division that we've had in our country over war. But the battle and struggle that we're a part of, we know the outcome. We understand the mission. We know the post-war plans of government that we represent. I'd like you to turn to Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah chapter 2. Of course, these are the immortal words of God as inspired by Isaiah that we often read at the Feast of Tabernacles. But I submit that really what we have here is a blueprint of the mission and its outcome of what we're involved in. We read this maybe regularly on a personal basis, but at least annually we read this. Why? To encourage ourselves that this is all worth it. I can't speak for all of you here, although I would suspect that there's a commonality between my motivation at the feast and yours. When I go to the Feast of Tabernacles, I come back encouraged that what I'm involved in, being a member of the church, is worth it. Well worth it. Isaiah 2 and verse 2. And it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, come, you, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Eternal from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among many nations, and he shall rebuke many people, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. And nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. How sad it is that in the years following World War II, the United States and other nations developed the United Nations, the headquarters of which was built in New York City, and at the front of which is a sculpture that was actually sculpted by a Russian sculptor. And on these very words are on the front of it. What have we learned in 75 years? 2 weeks ago on Memorial Day, Vice President Mike Pence of the United States laid a wreath at the base of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington National Cemetery. On that tomb are etched these immortal words. Here rests, in honored glory, an American soldier known but to God. Here rests, in honored glory, an American soldier known but to God. Brethren, there are other soldiers, known only to God, struggling for the most just of all causes. Those are the first fruits of God's family and his church. Those unknowns would be you and me. As we observe the Feast of Pentecost 2019, let us remember that because God gave us his law, because he gave us the power through the gift of his Holy Spirit, because of the growth and transformation in our lives that we submit to and seek out, because of the work and effort that we make to preach the true gospel message to this world, because of the sacrifice and struggle to care for those that God has called, that our efforts to bring true, lasting peace to the world, while not understood by most people now, will nonetheless not have been in vain.